Hello, my name is Michael Albert, and I'm the host of the podcast Revolution Z. This is the 16th episode. It's a new kind. It's in a sequence of episodes that it'll be about the election. There are two other sequences. One is deals primarily with vision, and one deals primarily with strategy. Before I begin, I would just like to suggest that you visit the Patreon site, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, so www.patreon.com/RevolutionZ, where you can find out a bit more about this podcast, Revolution Z, and you can also, should you choose to, help us out a bit. We certainly need it. The sequence that I'm about to begin on elections, and which will continue, just like the strategy sequence and the vision sequence are continuing, involves another change. Until now, unaccustomed to talking into a microphone with no people present and with no human feedback, I have scripted each podcast. But this time I'm going to do this with a minimal outline. Let me know if you find this approach better or worse. Okay, then, let's go with episode 16 of Revolution Z, titled Entering Election Season. To start, just to give you a feeling for where I am on this, I'm 72. I've been around for quite a few presidential elections. My guess is that this is the most important one in my lifetime. In fact, my guess is this may be the one most important one ever. So the reason I'm going to have a sequence of episodes dealing with the election is precisely because of its relative importance in history and today. In 2016, like many other people, I was horrified by the reality of Donald Trump even running for office, much less winning office as he did. My view during the election was what you might call a lesser evil approach. I thought that Donald Trump was the lesser evil compared to Hillary Clinton. I thought, therefore, that people should, where it mattered, that is in swing states where it was possible for one or the other to win as compared to it being a sure thing that one of them would win, that people should vote for Hillary Clinton. Trump won. That was a shock. Why did it happen? There's a tremendous amount of commentary dealing with, or there was a tremendous amount of commentary dealing with that question. Just as a providing a backdrop for this episode, I want to suggest three things that weren't dealt with quite as much as I think maybe was merited, and that have a rather different take to them than most of what was said, particularly on the left. The first was that Trump beat Clinton, but Clinton beat Sanders. And Clinton beat Sanders overwhelmingly because of the black vote for Clinton on Super Tuesday. That's what turned that primary run between the two of them to a victory for Clinton. And there's very little commentary about that, at least that I saw. But to me, it was very disturbing, and trying to understand how it could be the case was not so easy and was troubling. So imagine that the black vote in the southern states on Super Tuesday had split 50-50 for Sanders and Clinton. Or imagine it had voted the way the objective reality of the relative merits of those two candidates for the black community and for the society should have dictated, which would have been, you know, 95-5 for Sanders, or virtually 100-0 for Sanders. If that had happened, even 50-50, Sanders would have come away from Super Tuesday dramatically leading, and my guess is he would have won the nomination. It might not have been easy, but I think he would have won. If black community had voted for him as overwhelmingly as I think it should have, given the relative merits of Sanders versus Clinton, then he certainly would have won. So the question arises, well, why didn't that happen? Why didn't the black community vote for Sanders? Or more accurately, why did it vote for Hillary Clinton? The answer that everybody gives, and that I suspect is true, is that the black community had a special place for the Clintons. They regarded the Clintons as sort of honorary blacks. This was because of the persona of Bill Clinton, his easygoing camaraderie with people in the black community, his playing the saxophone, and so on and so forth. It certainly wasn't because of his real policies. And so the question arises, at least in my mind, how could, let's take my political lifetime from 1965 to 2016, how could, with all of the organizing that had gone on against racism and among black people in the United States, how could that happen? The black community is overwhelmingly to the left of any other community in the United States. It is overwhelmingly more progressive when it comes time to vote. Yet in this case, the black community came out for Clinton and stopped Sanders. That happened should teach us that there was something wrong, not with the black community per se, not just with the media, although of course there is, not just with popular culture, although of course there is, but with our organizing over those decades. The second big part of the victory of Trump came in the election itself against Clinton, and that was the vote of a good many working people, white working people. White working women voted more than 50% for a misogynist thug. White working men voted roughly the same, I guess, for a misogynist thug, a racist thug. But also a billionaire, somebody who had no interest whatsoever and had never displayed the slightest degree of interest in his real policies, in his real life activities, in the well-being of that constituency that voted for him. And so again, we have a problem. How did that happen? This time, I think, actually, it's sort of similar. I think that community of working people voted for Trump out of partly affinity and partly luck or a guess. Trump said he was going to help them. Trump said he wasn't just another politician. Well, the latter was believable. And because the latter was believable, even true, he wasn't just another politician, people thought, well, maybe he will do something. And Clinton certainly won't. And that's one reason that they liked him. And a second reason that they liked him is that he didn't come across as a elitist, Ivy League, what I call coordinator class, academically inclined professional, which working people, particularly in the constituencies and in the areas that voted for Trump, have no good feelings toward at all. It's a constituency that sees that coordinator class as being elitist, patronizing, dismissive, arrogant, and too rich. Again, we have to ask, how did this happen? If we go from 1965 to 2016 and we consider all of the political organizing done by progressives and leftists, how could it be the case that after all that, a substantial and incredibly large relative to the justification for it number of working people voted for Trump? After all, none of them should have voted for Trump. All of them should have hated Trump. How could so many vote for him? There must be something about all that organizing that left that door open, that did not touch the sentiments and the feelings and the misconceptions as well, which allowed for that vote. Yes, some voted for him because he was racist, and they were racist. Some voted for him because he was sexist and misogynist, and they were sexist or misogynist. But I suspect that was a relatively small factor in his success. I don't think that the reason why white workers who voted for Obama voted for Trump was because they were racist. All right, there was a third factor that I think needs to be addressed by leftists. Leftists like to address all the factors which are part of capitalism, which are ugly media behavior, which are ugly Democratic Party and Republican Party behavior. Okay, and there's nothing wrong with addressing all that. It has to happen. But it also ought to be the case that we look at ourselves. And there was another factor in this election, and that was the behavior of the Green Party. The reality is that one can feel that it's a great idea, that it's a wonderful project to try to develop a third party. And one can feel that doing that can be a progressive step, can even be a step leading toward fundamental change, and still be aware of the reality of the moment. The reality I speak of is a swing state in which the vote's going to be close and in which green votes could be the determining factor. And in that situation, for the Green Party leadership and for its candidate to decide to run and to decide even to some degree focus on those states precisely because it gave them a degree of power, and yet the power was to hurt the entire country and their own constituency and themselves if they swung the vote. And they did. That is to say, if Green votes in the various swing states, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, various swing states, had not been cast as they were, but had been cast for Clinton, holding one's nose and voting for somebody who you dislike or hate or abhor because it would make a difference, because Trump would be so much worse, was a possibility, but it wasn't adopted. And that's another reason why we got the outcome we got. Okay, so that left us with Donald Trump in office, slowly but surely, actually often rapidly and assuredly, demolishing victories from the past, rescinding gains that had been won, organizing the population to the extent that he could, and he is not bad at it. Characterizing him as just a total idiot misses the reality that, to a considerable extent, what he does very effectively. It's disgusting, but he is effective at it, and he should be taken seriously in that sense. In any case, we have him, and we have the harm and the damage that he's done. Before getting to the election that's coming up, which obviously involves him and one or another Democratic candidate, I want to present what I think would be the best argument against voting in general, and also the best argument for voting in general. I should reveal that at 72 years old, I have never voted for a presidential candidate in the United States. And I won't this time either, and there's no real reason for me to do so because I live in Massachusetts. And Massachusetts is not only not a swing state, it is a totally determined state. There is no question that the Democratic candidate, whoever it is, will win in Massachusetts. If that doesn't happen, then the entire country has voted for Trump, and we all better run for the hills. But in fact, Massachusetts will vote for the Democrat, whether the Democrat wins the overall election or not. And that means that, you know, I don't have to vote. And it is true that I don't like presidential elections. I think they are a gigantic distraction from life as it ought to be pursued. I think they are full of nonsensical verbiage, highlighting the worst in humanity and pulling along people into emphasizing that which is secondary and ignoring that which is primary. So I don't vote. However, what is the argument against voting in general coming from the left? What is it about voting that causes many leftists to feel that voting per se is a bad thing? And more, that actually supporting a candidate, for example, an organization, a union, or a political organization like, say, a socialist organization like DSA, which has recently grown very large, supporting a candidate is a horrible thing, is a bad idea. The argument is roughly this. By becoming involved in an election, you, to that degree, even just voting, but certainly to the degree of seriously supporting a candidate, you get sucked into a dynamic which distracts from organizing, distracts from developing movements seeking change, and which slowly but surely co-opts one's thinking processes and approach until one is bound up in the every 4 years dynamic of elections and is lost to the everyday dynamic of organizing movements for change. The argument is that the kinds of activity that are associated with supporting a candidate are generally top-down. They generally vest power in the candidate and in the candidate's closest functionaries and more locally in local party functionaries, where the base, to the extent that it is active at all, is basically just pulling levers, or even if it's going out and organizing, it's doing it according to a very limited description of how you should talk about the election and what you should say. So the argument against is that at best it's distraction and a waste of time, and at worst it sucks the energy of people and even the ideas and mindsets of people into a channel which is not suited to winning real fundamental change. The best argument for voting in general is that it is a way to conduct outreach and to organize that reaches far larger audiences than other ways. Every 4 years, the country focuses in on the presidential election. And to become involved in it, one can, by that means, reach a much larger audience than usual. And can, if one has the ability to retain one's awareness and understanding and mindset, can communicate to that larger audience as one wishes, and thereby having more effect than usual. The reality, I think, is a case-by-case matter. Neither argument is convincing in general, as a guideline that can't be breached. It is not true that the argument against voting is so strong that one should never vote. And it's not true that the argument for voting is so strong that one should always vote. Rather, it depends on the situation. It depends on whether or not one's vote or one's support for a candidate can make a difference. It depends upon whether or not, in making that difference for the candidate, it matters in the large. Does that candidate winning make a difference compared to the other candidate? It depends upon whether the process of working in the election can yield ongoing, lasting consciousness, lasting commitments, and even lasting organization for fighting for real change beyond just electing a person. If that's the case, then we have to ask, what about elections and fundamental change? And the answer is basically clear. An election can be part of the process of trying to win fundamental change in a country, including in the United States, if the election itself is critical to creating a context and a situation that's conducive to further change, and if the work that you do on the election, whether it be just voting or whether it be working hard for a candidate, is conducive to positive effects of a long-term nature. And this is something that one has to evaluate, given one's own situation, given the possibilities of what one might do, whether on a current election or something else instead. There's no one-size-fits-all answer. There's no one-size-fits-all answer for most things in politics or strategy. Okay, so now back to now. What about this election? First, why do I say it's so important? Well, even if there was no other reason, the state of the ecology, the reality of not just global warming, but ecological catastrophe, is enough to make this election incredibly important and perhaps most important of our history. I don't say these things lightly. Again, I'm 72. I have never subscribed to a sort of apocalyptic approach to politics. I've never subscribed to the idea that the way to motivate people, the way to move people, is to describe a situation in the most dramatic and this is the end terms as one can, either in the good direction or the bad direction. That is, I never have subscribed to the notion that one should say that if we do this next thing, all will be rosy. And I have never subscribed to the notion that if we don't do something, it will be the end for everyone. The reality now is, for the first time, I do feel that way. That is, I feel that if Trump wins this election, the results for the United States, the results for the whole planet, are so potentially and arguably likely horrific that it has to be prevented. And that, therefore, a Democrat beating Trump is incredibly important. But it's also important, and the best Democrats who are running, and so far I would have to say that's certainly Sanders and probably Warren, the best Democrats who are running are making perfectly clear that it isn't even enough. It is not enough to win the election. What has to happen is the election has to be won, and in the process of doing so, the electorate, the population, has to be so aroused, so inspired, that it is willing to continue on in the fight. It won't leave Sanders or Warren or whoever alone in the White House trying to buck up against the society's rich, its owners, the society's political elite, its establishment. It will instead fight and even push Sanders or Warren or whoever further than they would be inclined to go themselves. It will back them. It will lead them. That's what has to happen this election. We have to not only stop Trump, beat Trump, but we have to arouse an electorate so much that it stays in the game. It doesn't go home after the election. It, in fact, is aroused to continue on. About a week ago, I was visiting my sister in Connecticut, and she had a friend over. He was a writer. He had just written a novel, and he wanted to talk about that because she had told them that I wrote lots of books and the like. And he also wanted to talk about politics because she had told him, likewise, that I had been involved for politics since, you know, the dawn of time, and that it would be interesting. And he was a black guy with deep roots in the community. He was, I think, about 60, 65, I'm not sure. And after a while, we talked about various things. And then he said to me, well, okay, what do you think I should do? What do you think I should do given the incredible mess that we're in? And we had talked about just how precarious the situation of the country, of the society, of various communities, and of, indeed, the world was at the current moment. And I said, you know, ordinarily I would say that what you should do is the leftmost thing that you are inclined to do. Because if you don't do that, the likelihood of somebody else doing it instead is relatively low. If you sort of hold yourself back and do something that's less radical than you're willing to do, you're going into a role or a position that might have been filled anyway by somebody coming in the other direction. I'm not sure if that's totally clear. I hope so. The idea is if you do something to the right of what you might do, you may well be occupying a spot that somebody further to the right could have come and filled. But if you do something that's leftmost, well, then you're doing something that you're not taking a spot from anybody else. You're instead filling a spot that otherwise might not have been. And I suggested that while that's what I would often, in fact, as many times as I can remember in the past, have suggested, this time was different. This time I thought the thing to do was to figure out how, given his own inclinations, given his own contacts, of which he has many in the community, given his own disposition and what he was emotionally prepared to do, how he could best contribute to beating Trump. And on the way to that, to developing a lasting opposition that would then push the Democratic candidate, how he could help Sanders or Warren or whoever he preferred, but in my view, hopefully Sanders, to get the nomination, how he could help Sanders win, and how he could then push hard on Sanders in a movement that he helped build. I do think that that makes sense as a path or a course of action at this point in time. He's in Connecticut. It's not a guarantee that it would go either way, and I think he could do a lot there. I then spoke just the next day to my nephew, my sister's son, and the same thing happened. After a while, he just looked at me and he said, what do I do? He has two young daughters. He's scared for their future. He's scared for everyone's future. He's highly accomplished and capable. And I said to him pretty much the same thing. I said, I think you could find a way to become involved in the Sanders campaign or in the Warren campaign or whatever campaign on the Democratic side, and he does lean towards Sanders, you would feel comfortable working with, and you would feel you could be energetic working with, and you should contribute to it. I told him that I thought that he might be able to do that and to make serious contributions because he happens to have a lot of skills in communications. These kinds of action, I think, make sense this time. I can't remember an election in my lifetime in which I would have recommended such a thing to somebody. To me, a preferred left role in this election, a preferred left role, is to try to contribute to the Democratic candidate being the best one that we can possibly get. My own inclination right now is that that's Sanders. If I had to pick a second one right now, I'd say Warren. But, you know, things could change over time. There's a long ways to go. But anyway, to try and contribute to the candidate getting the nomination, and then to try to contribute to the candidate beating Trump, and also simultaneously trying to contribute to developing an ongoing progressive movement that would continue to push the candidate, back the candidate, but even push the candidate once the candidate is in office. That to me seems like a preferred left role. It also seems to me, coincidentally, I suppose you could say, to probably be the best way to, or the best avenue to reach a large audience, probably the largest audience one could reach, with desirable content, with desirable consciousness, in a manner that arouses desires and that raises awareness and that helps to facilitate ongoing movement activity. I find it very unlikely to think that there is any other national venue which could offer a better avenue to reaching people. Of course, if there's a mass strike that breaks out, say at Amazon, or if there's a big struggle of some other sort around immigration, well then, yes, one could become involved in that and might be able to, in that venue, so to speak, contribute even more to the development of an ongoing left activism that would push on a Canada. But for the most part, I do think in the year ahead, it may well be the case that relating to the election is the left activity that has both the best chance to reach out to a large audience and contribute to it, and the best chance to prevent absolutely apocalyptic outcomes. If not the preferred left role, then at least do no harm, the doctor's admonition. And by do no harm, I mean do not adapt a path which actually allows people to feel good about not voting for a Democratic Party candidate against Trump. Do not adopt a path. Do not adopt rhetoric which says, oh, it's fine to stay home. Oh, it's fine to not vote. Oh, it's fine. Not only is it fine to do that, but it's wrong to work for these candidates. People working for these candidates are sellouts. People working for these candidates are mere reformists. They don't care about fundamental change. Adopting that path not only doesn't do the preferred left role, not only doesn't contribute as much as possible, but at least to my mind, it does harm. It makes it easy. It supports. It provides sustenance to. It gives a sense of legitimacy to a path of action that has no legitimacy, which is not beating Donald Trump or even contributing to Donald Trump's victory. This is a brief overview of where at least I am entering election season. Maybe in the future we'll have, or definitely in the future we'll have, more podcasts addressing the unfolding election and trying to discern whatever it is about the election that is most important from the point of view not only of stopping Trump, but of developing a real movement for social change. That said, I do hope you will consider supporting Revolution Z via the Patreon website. And this is Michael Albert signing off for Revolution Z. Until next time.